It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Joe Biden made a stop in Westby in rural western Wisconsin on Thursday to announce new funding for rural electric companies.
Biden highlighted 16 rural electric co-ops set to receive billions of dollars for renewable energy projects through the Empowering Rural America program that's funded through the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act.
It includes Dairyland Power Cooperative that will receive $580 million to develop and purchase solar power, wind power, energy storage right here in Wisconsin and all across the Midwest.
We are learning about how this funding will affect clean energy and the power grid and the potential impact on rural customers with Lena Roald, an associate professor of engineering at UW-Madison who researches the electric grid and its ability to integrate renewable energy. Lena, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So President Biden announcing this funding in Westby, the USDA and the Biden administration calling this investment historic. How significant are these federal funds for rural electrification?
So they are very significant. And in particular for this grant for Dairyland Power, they have been stating that they expect the cost of electricity to be 42% lower for their customers than it would have been otherwise in a little time from now. And also they expect to be able to reduce their carbon emissions by 70%. So this is really impressive for Dairyland Power to have gotten this grant and be able to do this development of renewable energy. So it will be great for their customers. Historically speaking, it also connects back to when electric cooperatives were first started. So back in the 1930s, around 9 out of 10 rural households in America did not have access to electricity. And so there was a big effort by President Roosevelt to establish programs that would help electrify rural America. And it turned out that the organizations that would carry out this electrification is electric co-ops that are member-owned non-for-profit organizations that are owned by the people they serve. And so in a way, this program to help rural America access renewable energy really also ties back to that history, I think, of electric cooperatives.
90-some years ago, Lena, are there still badly needed electricity connections in hard-to-reach rural areas?
So I would say that this program that sought to electrify rural America has been a great success. Electric cooperatives serve, I think, more than 50% of the geographic regions of America. Mm. And they have about 42 million people that they serve. And one of the challenges for electric cooperatives in rural America is that it's not that many people there. And so you can imagine that in order to build electric wires to serve people, you cannot connect so many people per mile of wire that you have to put out. And that makes it expensive to serve rural households. But of course, it's also very important that those households have access to electricity. And so that is why it's so important with the electric co-ops.
But stepping back for a moment, we might see this infusion of money and say, you know, it is a power company. Are electric utility companies deserving of federal funds in the form of grants?
That is a question you could ask. So should the federal government be sponsoring this? Yeah. I mean, that is a little bit above my pay grade to decide. I guess that's politics. But I would say that I think it's important that there is this investment in the grid. The electric grid is a key enabler of the energy transition to cleaner energy. So investing in electric utilities and the electric grid and the generation from solar and wind power, you know, this would be much slower if the federal government wasn't also sponsoring this through grants. And so, for example, the Dairyland Power CEO was stating that, you know, with this grant, they will be able to make this transition to renewable energy much faster and more affordable for their customers than what would have been possible otherwise. And I think it's very positive that it is rural electric cooperatives that are also able to access this funding, not only big investor-owned utilities. So this is really a program that has targeted the rural co-ops that are serving people in sort of sparsely populated rural areas. And so I think that, you know, I think the federal government has an important role to play in ensuring that rural communities have access to affordable electricity as well.
We're talking with Lena Rowald, an associate professor of engineering at UW-Madison, about the Biden administration's recent announcement to allocate billions of dollars for electric cooperatives nationwide. Dairyland Power there in the mix. Biden made the announcement in rural western Wisconsin on Thursday. Lena, let's talk about what Dairyland Power Cooperative will be doing with these funds, planning to build 4 solar installations, 4 wind power installations. Can you first step back and explain generally where do most utilities get their energy from?
Yeah, so currently most utilities in our region are getting a lot of their energy from coal and natural gas. There is and also nuclear energy. There has been a big shift from coal generation to natural gas generation, and an increasingly a focus on transitioning to renewable energy from solar and wind. And so with this these new installations, Dairyland Power is going to be able to, you know, speed up their transition away from fossil fuels such as coal and natural gas, and then try and, you know, move towards carbon-free energy, renewable energy from solar and wind.
Storage has been a concern with renewable energy like wind and solar. Are there new advancements in energy storage?
Yeah, so there is a lot of advancements that are happening on the energy storage side. We also have here in Wisconsin also projects that are kind of leading the way on that. Aligned Energy has a project called Energy Dome that is looking into, you know, new technology for energy storage that is not only relying on batteries. But yeah, there is energy storage in the form of batteries is also very important in the context of renewable energy, because it can allow us to fill up the batteries when it's sunny or windy, and then discharge the battery, for example, later in the day after the sun sets. So battery energy storage and energy storage in general is an important complement to clean energy from solar and wind.
When you look at an investment in 4 solar installations and 4 wind power installations, are there a lot of startup costs there? And how do you integrate that type of capital into the power grid?
Yeah, so with solar and wind, as you mentioned, there is some startup costs. You have to make an initial investment in order to build the plants. Mm-hmm. But once you have built them, they are kind of running at very, very low cost, right? There is no, you don't have to pay for sun, you don't have to pay for wind. And so this means that these days, the cheapest energy that we can get is from renewable energy, such as solar and wind. And I think that is also speaks to the fact, you know, when we hear that Dairyland Power is saying that they are expecting their customers to pay significantly less for electricity with this investment, that is also because they will no longer have to pay for natural gas or coal in order to fuel their power plants. And so that is very beneficial also from a cost perspective to be able to transition to solar and wind. However, there is a lot of uncertainty associated with solar and wind. We don't always know how much sun or wind there is going to be. And so there can be uncertainty about exactly how much and where, when we are going to get that electricity. And so that can sometimes make it harder for utilities and cooperatives to actually get the investment covered and do financing of their projects. And so that is, you know, a grant like this can really help fuel more investments and kind of take away some of that uncertainty and thereby also help create more investment in solar and wind.
How in need are rural areas for this type of investment?
So let's say it like this. I mean, I think, you know, if you go around, you see a lot of wind and solar plants being built. Mm-hmm. And these are typically located in rural areas, right? Because mm-hmm. there is space there to place the solar panels and the wind turbines. And I think we can think about this kind of investment in rural America as a way for those communities that are the rural communities that where those plants, the wind power plants and the solar power plants are located, to also directly benefit from those plants. Other times, you know, if you live in a city, there is not so much space to build wind and solar in the city. And so utilities in the cities have to contract with power plants that are outside of the city, typically in rural areas. And so then they are importing the electricity from the rural area to the city. And so I just think that this program that helps rural cooperatives also access and not only sort of host the renewable energy, but also have access to using that electricity for their own benefit, I think is really important in order for us to, you know, make sure that the build out of renewable energy is kind of fair.
So as the $7.3-ish billion plays out and goes into these types of projects, what are you watching for?
So I think this project, you know, these projects, they are really important in order to allow the electric grid to continue to become greener. Mm-hmm. It is really important to support electrification. I mean, for example, installation of heat pumps or electric vehicles. So the type of things where we previously have been using fossil fuels to power parts of our lives. And so, you know, building out this renewable energy can allow us to do this electrification without at the same time increasing, for example, generation from natural gas or coal power plants. So this is very important. Mm-hmm. Another aspect of the investments that is currently happening in the electric grid and also in rural parts of the country is that the grid needs to become more resilient to extreme weather. So as the climate is changing, there are new challenges that occur, you know, for example, more extreme rainfall or more severe windstorms and frequent windstorms or thunderstorms. And in some parts of the country, we're also looking at very high wildfire risk. And so in making sure that we can, you know, keep the grid running in that setting is also a very important part of this.
Lena, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Lena Roald is an associate professor of engineering at UW-Madison.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, find out how a UW-Green Bay effort aims to protect older Wisconsinites from scams and fraud with response teams around the state.
The more we have these teams, the stronger our state will be in supporting older adults.
That's next here on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Along with religion and money, politics is one of those subjects you're not supposed to discuss in polite company. The topic has only gotten more intense in recent years, thanks in part due to the more heated language being used by politicians.
As Hope Kerwin reports, the incivility from candidates and elected officials has left many voters frustrated by the tone that continues to dominate this year's election.
Ann Bartels has worked with kids for more than a decade as an educator for Marinette County. She feels like some elected officials have forgotten the things they learned in kindergarten, like how to get along with other people.
I'm sure some of the children I work with could run things a little bit better than some of the people that are currently, you know, holding positions.
In the current election year, it's impossible to avoid the name-calling and personal attacks that Bartels sees as childish behavior, especially in the presidential race.
Sleepy, crooked Joe Biden or laughing Kamala?
These guys are creepy and, yes, just weird as hell. That's what you see.
That's Democratic VP nominee Tim Walz and before him, Republican former President Donald Trump, who escalated the tone of personal attacks during the 2016 election. The more aggressive language resonates with some voters, especially those who support Trump. But others say they're tired of the vitriol, like Bartels. She's an independent voter, but says she leans toward Democrats.
We can disagree, but be courteous about it and not devolve into silly name-calling or personal insults or, you know, telling your supporters to be violent. That sort of thing just isn't what America's about.
For some Wisconsinites, the incivility in politics has started to bleed into their relationships with family and friends. Through WPR's engagement project, America Amplified, more than a dozen listeners said it was one of the top issues for them in this election year. One of them was Leonard Schroeder. The retired high school ag teacher doesn't support either political party, but he especially dislikes Trump, saying the Republican nominee has inspired his supporters to adopt the same kind of aggressive behavior. Schroeder feels like many of his neighbors in Cadott are that way, but he was shocked when one of his comments on Facebook sparked the same type of attack from a former school colleague, someone he considered a friend.
In fact, I used to spend lots of time talking to him and basically replied to my comment, he accused me of being brainwashed and stupid.
In a national survey from January, 7 out of 10 Americans say elected officials should avoid heated or aggressive language because it could encourage some people to take violent action. But the report by Pew Research Center found a growing partisan divide. While the vast majority of Democrats said they're opposed to aggressive language, just over half of Republicans responded that way. And Pew found that Republicans are more likely today to say the use of heated language is fine than they were in 2019. Lee Roche from nonpartisan civic group Leader Ethics said this corresponds with a dramatic decline in all Americans' trust in their fellow citizens. He said the personal attacks being woven into ads, campaign speeches, and online messaging would not have been accepted just a dozen years ago.
The concern I think we have to have is that we can become accustomed to incivility as being not only acceptable, but it could be viewed as the way to get elected or reelected.
While it might be too late to choose a different path in this year's election, Roche hopes it could be the low point that pushes voters to demand more civility and bipartisanship from their elected officials. Roche's group, Leader Ethics, is part of a growing number of organizations across the U.S. that are trying to mend divisions. Many have also focused their message on election security, promoting both trust in the voting process and a peaceful acceptance of the results. At a workshop in Kenosha this summer, National Civic Group Urban Rural Action taught participants how to navigate political disagreements and recognize when someone may be moving toward violence. Perry Singh of Muskego is one of the group's members.
You don't have to join any organization to do this type of work. It starts from the home. It starts from your own local community. It starts from your own street.
He hopes their message of peace will resonate with voters on both sides of the aisle, regardless of what happens in November. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Financial scams are a booming business worldwide, and seniors are some of the biggest targets of those scams and other kinds of financial abuse.
In 2022, senior citizens in Wisconsin lost over $40 million to financial abuse. That's according to the Elder Justice Coalition here in Wisconsin.
Based at UW-Green Bay, the coalition is trying to combat this problem with new financial abuse specialist teams throughout the state.
Laura Nolan is Associate Director for Business and Government Outreach at UW-Green Bay. She's part of the Brown County Dementia Friendly Coalition and the Wisconsin Coalition to End Social Isolation and Loneliness. And Debbie Leese is a program specialist for the Wisconsin Elder Justice Coalition at UW-Green Bay. Debbie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
You're welcome.
And Laura, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Laura, can you start us off by talking about how common financial abuse is for seniors here in Wisconsin?
A lot of people don't understand how often financial abuse happens, and it's actually highly underreported right now. A lot of people are embarrassed to say that they were scammed by someone outside of their realm, or that even there's a lot of issues when it comes to family members who are taking advantage of an older adult's money. I think Debbie would probably have some great numbers that she could throw in right now.
Yeah, Debbie, what do we know? Acknowledging that some of this is underreported probably, what do we know?
So 1 in 24 cases are reported, and in 2023, in Wisconsin alone, among the older and vulnerable population, $46 million was lost. And of that $46 million, only $3 million was able to be recuperated.
And part of the effort here, you've got this grant to do a lot of things related to elder abuse. And part of the effort here, Debbie, is the financial abuse specialist teams, getting those set up in communities. Can you talk us through this model? What is that going to look like?
Absolutely. So currently, Wisconsin has four existing financial abuse specialist teams. And with that, it's a multidisciplinary team that comes together to share resources, discuss current scams and trends, and to work together collaboratively to address those issues. So the grant, in our grant, our goal is to bring five additional teams to the state. Wisconsin is a county-led state, so with the 72 counties, our adult protective services have 72 different ways of doing things. And we need to make sure that we're combining our resources and addressing these issues. So we're going to make sure that there's at least one financial abuse specialist team in each of the five APS regions.
Laura, the FAST team is part of this wider effort. I understand you co-wrote the grant, so working with the Department of Justice. Can you tell us about the scope of the problems we're tackling and what kind of solutions will come as part of this grant?
Right. So the first goal was to first establish the permanent Wisconsin Elder Justice Coalition and to make sure that we had good representation within the state, that we have minority groups represented, that we're really looking at the 72 counties and ways that the coalition can help support on a statewide effort to reduce elder justice inequities that occur, whether they are abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. So in this first two-year period, we're doing the FAST teams, which we just talked about. We're also doing elder death review team creation. And with both of these projects, we're creating toolkits. So while Debbie talked about having these five teams, we actually would love to have even more teams established. We also have just completed a needs assessment of prosecutors, financial institutions, healthcare, and several other groups that we are now going to work on education for those groups. How can they better understand the issues around elder justice and abuse and what they can do to help strengthen our safety net to protect older adults? And finally, we'll be doing some local education for local government and also statewide for our legislature on what are the elder justice issues in Wisconsin and how can we better protect older adults.
Debbie, can you expand on some of what Laura was saying there about partnerships and coalitions? Who are you hoping has a seat at the table, whether it's coming up with these financial abuse specialist teams or these other efforts to stop elder financial abuse?
So to bring to the table for our FAST teams, we are hoping to have adult protective services on each team, the Aging and Disability Resource Centers, Corporate Counsel, Department of Agricultural Trade and Consumer Protection. Department of Financial Institutions is going to try to get representation on each of those new teams. We need elder law attorneys, financial service providers such as guardians, healthcare personnel, so geriatricians, law enforcement, Medicaid programs. So that's that core group. And then we have suggestions for additional members as well.
Laura, one thing I wonder about is you mentioned at the outset that these are underreported crimes, often scams. What can we do to encourage people to report them, to have financial institutions watch out for them? What do we need to do to understand how often these kind of things are happening?
Yeah, I think it's number one is for people to report and know that there are resources out there. So we have the state hotline, which is 1-833-586-0107. You can also go online and go to the reportelderabusewisconsin.org. And that has resources and is manned with people who can help answer those calls, get support. Our Scam Singo, which is free and available on our website for anyone who interacts with older adults, if it's a church group, a service organization, just you and your neighbors want to have fun playing a game and learn about the different scams that are out there. It's set to music, so it's bingo set to music. I think a lot of it is education so that people know what they can do ahead of time and then what they can also do when something happens. It, just because you were scammed doesn't mean there isn't help out there.
We're talking to Laura Nolan, Associate Director for Business and Government Outreach at UW-Green Bay, and Debbie Lease, Program Specialist for the Wisconsin Elder Justice Coalition, talking about their efforts to help prevent and report elder abuse, focusing in on elder financial abuse, whether by someone they know, maybe a family member, or these online scams. Well, I want to pick up with that Singo thing. I'm looking at the guidelines for it now, and these are songs that are used then to illustrate different kinds of scams that people might encounter that often target seniors. Debbie, I've got Can't Buy Me Love by the Beatles in front of me here as a warning of online romance scams. And these are big, big business these days. Can you talk a little bit about how Singo highlights this particular kind of scam?
Absolutely. So we talk about the romance scams and, you know, where, you know, sometimes they'll get you with a text like, hey, are we still on for that Korean barbecue tomorrow? And then, of course, the Midwest Nice, we're going to respond, oh, I think you have the wrong number. And now you're drawn in. So then they establish a relationship. But as you're building that relationship, then you make plans to meet and tragedy strikes. So there's a problem with their car. They need money for an airplane ticket. Maybe they're in the military and they're having a difficulty getting through customs. So they need you to send them money so that they can meet up with you. The meeting never happens. So we encourage the older and vulnerable population through the Scam Singo to, you know, make sure that they're never sending money to somebody that they've never met, especially. So someone they meet online or via text.
Laura, we've been talking about online scams. How about financial abuse of elders by someone that in theory they should be able to trust, a loved one, maybe somebody who has financial power of attorney or other people in that sort of position? What kind of things can we do to help prevent that kind of abuse?
Yeah, I think it's important to plan ahead and to think about the family members you have and to put together your financial power of attorney and your healthcare power of attorney paperwork ahead of time. And find people within your family situation who are stable, who you trust and you know will be able to handle those financial decisions for you. I think number one is getting that paperwork set up. And number two is I think families being aware it's okay to ask questions. So if somebody else is the one handling the finances and it seems like mom doesn't have food available or they're not getting the healthcare things they need, knowing that there are resources through Adult Protective Services in each of our counties to help with those situations so they can investigate and look at the situation to make sure that that finances for that older adult are being used for that person.
Debbie, you're talking about creating more of these FAST groups, the financial abuse specialist teams. There are a few, I understand, already active. What kind of things have they been doing? What kind of results are you seeing?
So correct. We do have four. We have one in Dane County, Waukesha, Walworth in Milwaukee, and each FAST is separate. So they're run differently. They have different goals. We would like to see FAST review cases. Most of them, it's about building relationships and pooling resources to, again, review those trends and address their own individual county needs. Again, I think pooling resources is the best outcome of all of the FAST teams, where they're getting to the answers quickly because law enforcement has access to resources that Adult Protective Services or just doesn't have, or financial institutions have access to resource that law enforcement might not have. So it's coming together and working for the same goal.
Laura, it sounds like a core issue here is awareness of elder abuse, financial and otherwise. How important is it just getting the message out there to seniors and family members and financial institutions and law enforcement? And the list goes on and on. How much of this is an awareness issue?
Oh, I think the awareness issue is huge. So we need to continue to educate to make sure banks understand the part they play. Prosecutors understand how they can prosecute. Sometimes they don't, it gets leery where somebody maybe has some cognitive memory issues. Knowing what that person can still testify and provide in a case so that we can really get the people who are causing these crimes to be prosecuted and stop the chain of it continuing to happen.
Debbie, as we wrap up, if people are out there thinking, hey, I'm one of the people you've been talking about in financial institutions, law enforcement or whatever, I'd like to get involved. What can people do to reach out and work with the Elder Justice Coalition?
Absolutely. If they want to email elderjustice@uwgb.edu, we can reach out then. I've been meeting with counties individually, or if there's an individual who's not connected with the county yet and has an interest in resources available, then we'll meet collectively and see what we can do to set up a team in their county.
Debbie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Laura, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for getting the information out about this important subject.
Debbie Lease is a program specialist for the Wisconsin Elder Justice Coalition at UW Green Bay, and Laura Nolan is the university's associate director for business and government outreach.
Join WPR tonight at 8 for live coverage of the ABC News presidential debate simulcast from NPR with Republican former President Donald Trump and Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a UW-Madison program aims to make international study more affordable for students. Meet two of those students who made connections with people from around the world.
I got to know their story, but then they also got to know mine.
That's coming up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. According to UW-Madison, more than 2,500 Badgers participated in a study abroad program in the most recent school year.
Taking college courses outside of the U.S. can be a great opportunity to meet new people, encounter different cultures and perspectives, and learn more about yourself.
But that experience can be expensive, which can keep students from considering study abroad programs. For the last decade, the Global Gateway Initiative at UW-Madison has been helping bring down that barrier.
The program provides scholarships for students to participate in three-week intensive programs in one of three global locations. It also provides fellowships that help cover the costs of longer study abroad programs.
Two participants joined us for a firsthand look, along with the study abroad program leader from UW. Samantha Flores is a junior at UW-Madison who studied in Botswana. Stacy Tran is a 2024 UW grad who went to Singapore last year. And Dan Gold is director of international academic programs at UW-Madison. They joined me last week here in the studio. I started by asking Dan about the program and the goals behind it.
Yeah, the Global Gateway Initiative is a program run by International Academic Programs, which is the Central Study Abroad office at UW-Madison. Starting in 2014, we had an idea that we wanted all students on campus to be able to have access to these wonderful life-changing study abroad experiences. Almost 30% of UW-Madison students study abroad, but that leaves most students who don't have this experience. So what this program is are three-week faculty-led experiences for around 15 first- and second-year students, fully funded. So we take financial barriers completely out of the equation.
And Dan, when I think back distantly to my college years, I assumed study abroad was off the table for me. I thought, oh, we can't afford that. And that's the mentality you're trying to overcome here, right?
Exactly. For this, for the students who think study abroad isn't for me, we want them to think this is a life-changing experience. This will benefit me academically, personally, professionally, and I can access it. We want every student on campus to have this belief.
And Stacey, what put studying abroad and the Global Gateway Initiative on your radar?
When I first transferred into the university, I wanted to maximize every opportunity out there. As a returning adult student, this is my second chance of doing college again. So I was looking at study abroad opportunities and came across the Global Gateway Initiative, which, as Dan mentioned, lifts all financial barriers. And the worst that could happen was a no. So I applied, and I specifically wanted to go to Singapore because of my interest in their sustainability efforts. And I've heard from everyone that if you can, do study abroad at least once in your life, because it can change your life, and it did for mine.
Samantha, what got you interested in studying abroad?
Yeah, similar to Stacey, I had heard about the program from a friend. So my sophomore year, I really dug into it and took a look at what my options were. And I just had always been told, like, similar to Stacey, how if you can study abroad, you should definitely take that opportunity. And as someone who had never left the country for the first time, when I looked at Global Gateway and saw that that like financial barrier was something I did not have to worry about if I got into the program, was something that really drew me to the program, because it would have never been something that I thought I could even accomplish or even go on. But then also specifically with Botswana, I chose Botswana because a lot of the content in the course was social global problems. And I specifically was really interested in like the social, economic, and political discourses that we were going to be having on the program. So, yeah.
Dan, take us through a little bit of the history of the program and how it's grown over the years.
Yeah, it started in 2014 with one program and 15 students in Shanghai. And since then, we've been able to run 14 iterations with over 200 students. This past summer, we were able to send students to Botswana, Singapore, and D.C., Washington, D.C. For us, it's really just having programs around the world in locations students might not otherwise be thinking about it. We mix up the themes, we mix up the faculty. So again, it's trying to pitch as broad a tent as possible so we could match all students' interests and backgrounds to having an opportunity that might help them. And so now it's, you know, we're up to over 50 students a year being able to take advantage of these opportunities.
All right, let's get to the fun part now and visit Singapore and Botswana. Stacey, start us off. You're off the plane in Singapore, just there from Wisconsin. What was that initial experience like?
Oh my gosh, it was enamoring, vivid, humid, unreal, hot. I didn't realize how close Singapore was to the equator, so that was a humbling lesson for me geographically. But I was just amazed by being encased by the amount of tropical plants that I try to grow at home, but also by the amount of diversity that was there, whether it was religious, ethnically, or racially. There was so much diversity in Singapore that I wasn't anticipating. And in addition to that was just the smells. I could still smell all the food vendors, the savory, the sweet, the sounds of just the bustle of the city. And that was just like my first impression of the country, honestly.
We're going to come back to that food, by the way. Samantha, take us to your first impressions of Botswana.
Yes. So as I get off the plane, we're entering the airport and it's very hot and dry. So as we're entering, it's very calm too. As you enter the airport, as you can imagine, a lot of the airports we've been to are very chaotic. And so as you enter the airport, it's very calm. As you give people like your passport, everybody's so welcoming. Everybody's super excited to see you, but also they're super curious to know why you're there. And I always found that really exciting, just because I got to know their story, but then they also got to know mine. And so, yeah, that was kind of my experience, but everybody was really welcoming since the beginning.
We're talking about UW-Madison's Global Gateway Initiative to help make study abroad more accessible to students. We've got two recent participants, Stacey Tran, Samantha Flores, both with us, and Dan Gold, Director of International Academic Programs at UW-Madison.
Dan, talk about study abroad as a part of education, a way to enhance the learning experience.
Yeah, I mean, study abroad, I mean, we really see it as an opportunity for growth, you know, for all students. But when you look at it conceptually, basically it's just, you know, what can you do that's not on campus that will help your academic goals? And so basically, you know, the opportunities are endless. You could go with a faculty member and study one, you know, subject in the field research. You could enroll in one of the, you know, finest universities abroad and spend a semester or a year there. You could immerse yourself in language learning, for example, for a year in Germany and in our one of our programs there. Basically, whatever your major is, we're saying we can give you real world experience, experiential, you know, learning experience that's going to help engage you in your major, help you grow, help you gain independence. And, you know, in the end, the goal is it'll help lead you to, you know, professional development and good employment and, you know, value in what you're doing after you graduate.
Now, Samantha, let's start with you looking at the educational value. What do you feel like you got out of this intensive 3-week stretch in Botswana?
Definitely. So like I mentioned before, I took a course called Global Social Problems, and it really delved into social, economic, and political things occurring in Botswana. So with the course, I had two professors, and one of my professors is a sociology professor, and the other one's a law professor here at the university. So when I was engaging in these discussions and with the entire group, it was always very interesting to find those different perspectives from all around the table, just because I was the only business major on the program, but also a lot of the other students on the program, they were pre-health or going into like the medical field. So also hearing their perspective on how they were experiencing the program was something very interesting. And we kind of went off of each other in areas where we didn't know or have so much knowledge about. So I really spoke to like the economy and all of that aspect as a business major, but then I was also able to learn a lot from my peers and my professors. So yeah.
Stacey, you're I think a year out now from this Singapore learning experience. What did you take away from it?
My program was led by Dr. Gujan Buniman, and we were learning and exploring the religious diversity in Singapore. And for me, I studied education, policy, and information science. So religion doesn't explicitly tie into that. But what I realized while being at Singapore was that so much of our learning was experiential, and it could be applied in and out of the classroom. So for our cohort, we visited many temples, mosques, churches, and we got to meet with the local leaders of those respective religious spaces. And the beauty behind that was that we were able just to chat and ask questions in a safe space. And that was so valuable. And this concept of community building kept coming up. And I think earlier I mentioned food. A lot of these spaces, they also offer free meals to the community. And it was such a privilege to be able to, for all 20 of us to sit down with these locals and these leaders of these religious spaces and just eat food and ask questions. And that concept, I really summarize as like breaking bread builds community. And that has really found itself in how I carry myself in the classroom and outside of it too.
Dan, looking to the future, what are your hopes for the Gateway program?
Yeah, our hopes is, I mean, just seeing the growth in the students who have been on the program and the wonderful and exciting things that they have done, you know, coming back to Madison, bringing it back to the Madison community, what they've gone on after graduation, just really inspires, you know, us at UW-Madison to continue the program and to make it available to even more students. So we try to have them in every region of the world, you know, Asia, Africa, and the U.S. We have them now. We were hoping to also add one in Latin America in the future years and keep rotating the subjects. So like having a program in sustainability and other areas to really engage, you know, students of all majors to say, yes, this is an experience for you. This will help develop you and what you want to do in your career.
So when I come to a new place, at the top of my agenda, you know, it's going to be the food. Stacey, let's start with you. What kind of food did you encounter in Singapore that you came to love?
First thing that comes to mind is laksa, which is a coconut-based seafood soup with noodles. Beautiful. I also think of the desserts. With it being so hot and humid, there's a lot of sweet desserts that are also fruit and icy. So like chendol is one of them. And so many of these dishes, now that we're talking, they're coming very vividly back to me, like satay, like meat on a stick with peanut sauce or tofu, like so many different ways of preparing a protein or like a vegetable that I like didn't realize was an option. So a lot of those things I've been making at home and making it for our cafe pop-up, just like random lattes with that's inspired by these desserts or focaccia that has laksa and curry powder, just random stuff that I think you would enjoy too.
Samantha, any food memories you want to share from Botswana?
Yes. So the first night we actually got a taste of Botswana. So we were able to have like an array. And I know that a lot of the foods in Botswana are very similar to like things that we eat here, such as like even rice, but a lot of it is like a different like form of seasoning. And then that's what's really makes it like their own food. So my favorite thing was that night. And specifically, I really enjoyed the beef that we had that night. It was pulled beef. And that night, it was just an incredible night because it was just not specifically the food, but we also got to experience like the dance and other aspects of the culture.
Wow.
And they taught us their specific dances. And we also got to meet local college students in that setting. So kind of how I describe it is like it was kind of a gift that kept on giving, in the sense of like it continued to just like get better as the night went on. But yeah.
Fantastic. Dan, I wanted to ask, we're talking about programs in Africa and Asia. Now, sometimes people think study abroad, they're thinking Western Europe. Is that intentional, going to places that aren't the top of the list for a lot of people?
No, very much so. I mean, Europe does remain the most popular destination for students overall. But one of our purposes with this program is really to bring students to places they might not have thought of otherwise. That's why Botswana, Singapore, even Washington, D.C., domestic programs. So to really, studying a theme in a particular location, there could be wonderful experiences that students might not have initially thought of. So students certainly can have a wonderful time in London, but they also could have a wonderful time in Botswana. And they might, it opens up doors that they might not have otherwise even dreamed of before. So,
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Samantha and Stacey, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Samantha Flores is a junior at UW-Madison. Stacey Tran is a 2024 UW grad. And Dan Gold is Director of International Academic Programs at UW-Madison. We talked to them about the university's Global Gateway Initiative to help more students access study abroad opportunities.
You can join WPR tonight at 8 for live coverage of the ABC News presidential debate simulcast from NPR with Republican former President Donald Trump and Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris.
NPR's Mary Louise Kelly hosts this live special coverage, and NPR correspondents will offer some analysis, help put the debate into a wider perspective.
The debate starts at 8 o'clock here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org.
Fun fact about me, I was a map nerd growing up, so what? I'm excited about a conversation we have coming up this week. It's true.
We'll find out why one Wisconsin community was accidentally left off of an official map and how they had fun with it. And we'll dig into some other mysteries of Wisconsin map making, including phantom communities that show up on maps but aren't really there.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have something like this in your area? A community that exists in real life isn't on a map? Or something that you see maybe in an online map that doesn't match up with anything in the real world.
Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us at 888-642-0232.
And we can share your mysterious map mysteries on a future show.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.